I really can talk about playwrights. I can talk about me. That will take us 6 hours at least. But I don't know too much about other playwrights. I just know something about me. And I suppose the best place to start really is we're in Philadelphia, which is where I was born. Did a lot of things in Philadelphia, I guess. It's interesting to see all these people here. I'm a little nervous. I used to be an actor. I actually acted at the Drama Guild. I don't know how many. Is Sidney Bloom here or something? No, I guess not. Huh? Sidney? I mean, Drama Guild, I was actually an actor. And I was in The Firebugs there, directed by Dennis Cunningham, who's gone over to the other side and become a critic. I did The Miser with Joe Leonardo, who's a very talented director. And Dennis did The Rivals. And I did a lot at Temple University. I was actually an actor there a lot. I called it acting. A lot of people didn't. You know, acting out. But anyway, like a lot of people, I think, who write plays, I started out really doing a lot of things. The only thing I wouldn't do was stage crew work, because I don't like physical labor. But I would do everything else, actually. I mean, I was really into just the whole thing of the theater. And then I started writing plays. And actually, my very first play that I still admit to is called Urlicht, U-R-L-I-C-H-T. It's actually going to be published next year. But I wrote it a long time ago, when I was like 20. And it was done at the Theater of the Living Arts. And I don't know how many of you remember the Theater of the Living Arts, but in the old days, they had a new play program, and they did this play of mine. It was about a nun who kills rats in a subway tunnel with a baseball bat. It was slightly bizarre. But actually, Ernie Scheer gave me my first good review, actually, for that play. I think it was a little hedged, like all critics, you know, but it was generally very favorable. And my mother said to me after reading that review, "Well, I didn't realize it was a sick play." But they've gotten used to worse since. So I have really a lot of roots in the theater in Philadelphia. I learned a great deal about the theater in Philadelphia. When I was at Temple, it was actually sort of in the old days before this great machine of university theater took over. It was essentially a small department there. And I think that's very useful. That's changed a lot in educational theater now. It's become very mechanized and very, very large. Since there's no longer a theater profession for most people, all of these programs are now professional programs, training people to be taxi drivers and waiters and so on. But when I was at Temple, there really wasn't much illusion. It was simply done for the love of doing theater. And with Paul Randall and Art Cattells especially, I think I learned an enormous amount about directing and acting. And that's what the theater, I mean, that's really what a playwright draws from, is those sorts of experiences. You're writing for actors and for a director. And when you work with people like that, and like Dennis even at the Drama Guild, you know, you really learned a lot about what playwrights do. So I feel actually very much spawned in Philadelphia. After Temple, I went to a place called the California Institute of the Arts. I don't know how many of you have heard of that school. Some people call it Mickey Mouse U. It was funded by the Disneys. It's true. And the Disneys are exceptionally right-wing, as most of you will know. But the school went out of its way to attract every single radical person on the East Coast. And I remember Dougal MacArthur was there, and Herb Lauer in the theater. And the third week of school at Cal Arts, all the trustees came. These were all these people from the Disney family and their friends who had put $5 million each into this. And they all came in their suits and in their chauffeured limousines. And two young men got dressed as erect penises and walked around spitting mayonnaise in front of these people. It's true. And then the next week, the school was raided for nude bathing. And of course, this was the time of freedom and self-determination. But if you didn't bathe nude, you weren't allowed to swim. So I left CalArts because between the dressing up as penises and naked swimming, there didn't seem to be much to learn. So I went to Yale at that point, at the drama school. I gather that you've had Mr. Brustein here a few weeks ago. He's gone to Boston to sabotage theater there, having been fired from Yale, the answer to all of our prayers, you know, when I was there, but of course he never was. So I suppose he gave you all of his nonsense about all of that. I learned a lot at Yale, how to apply for grants, and very important for a playwright's survival. And then I went to New York, and I answered the phone for a market research corporation, which was a front for a madhouse. I was a messenger, but it was very, very rainy that season, so I didn't last too long as a messenger. I won a Guggenheim, which was okay, and then I ran out and I got sick and became a coder. And Yale, actually, oddly enough, though I was very much disliked there, and in fact was almost thrown out because I wouldn't do crew, at the rate of at least three times a year, they were always yelling me. But they asked me to write a piece for their playwrights, and I did, and I said the main thing the playwright should do is learn how to type, take dictation, then run a stat machine. Because when I got in trouble, when my Guggenheim ran out, and I was sick, actually, I had to become a coder. And what I've mostly learned in making a career was how to code, how to read documents, legal documents from the telephone company. Am I giving away something I shouldn't give away? I think you sign a little piece of paper, right? I have some friends here who did this. You sign this little paper when you go, you know, and they say you won't talk about the job. But I won't tell you what the suit was about, but you have to read these legal documents and code them on what they call bed sheets. I did that for a while, but I was sort of fired from that job because I wasn't very good at it. And so I had sort of a rough time. I mean, I know that a lot of people think I've just been lucky, and I have been incredibly lucky, but it was preceded by lots of problems, lots of trauma. When I talk about the theater, I often say that there isn't a theater anymore in America, and unfortunately, that's kind of the tenor of my feeling about it. Some people point at me as a proof that that's not true. But unfortunately, I think I am a proof that it is true, because of all the talented playwrights I know, and I know a great many because I've been in many programs, I'm one of three or four who makes a living in the theater. And that's a terrible figure. And the only reason I've had a career and a success is because I was very lucky, because of extraordinary amounts of coincidences that none of you would believe in a B-movie from 1940. Gemini, which is, I suppose, my big success, began off Broadway and ran 11 performances. Not 12, because an actress quit, but we talked her into staying for 11. She wouldn't stay for 12. And that was it. That was really it. We all gave up in despair when a theater in Long Island called PATH lost a play on a Friday, desperately needed a play. The guy who runs PATH came down and said, I'll look at this Gemini by Ian Rotoro. He looked at it and said, well, that's not too bad. I guess we'll have to go with it. At least it's ready to go. So he signed the papers on Sunday with my agent, and we went into rehearsal at PATH on the Monday. We ran at PATH for 4 weeks, did rather well, and we thought we would close. We couldn't interest any single commercial producer in New York, including Joe PATH, who's always very nice to me personally but hates my plays. We couldn't interest any of these people into doing the play, and so we thought we would close. Circle Rep, which is a kind of a blurry theater, half off and half off Broadway, lost the play on a Monday. And I ran into Marshall Mason, who runs the Circle Rec in the bank, and I said, Marshall, how are you? And he said, oh, who are you? And I said, I wrote a play called Gemini. He said, oh, I didn't like it. Oh, is it still running? He said. I said, well, it's at PATH. It's closing in a week. He said, oh, my God, we just lost Julie's play. You think we can do it? I said, well, sure. So he and his staff, he said, now, what sign are you? And I said, a Gemini. I said, well, I'm a Pisces, and Lamford is an Aries, but it all adds up to Gemini, so I think we can do Gemini. So he and his staff went out and saw Gemini and sort of thought it was okay, and they brought it in, and then we opened off-Broadway. Now, as it had happened, I had another play called The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie, which I think was done here last year. I don't know how many of you saw it here last year, but it was done here. I gather it wasn't funny here. It's very sad. And that play isn't funny. It's a very bad play. Well, anyway, so nobody else sees the humor but me, I must say, whenever I go to rehearsal. But we had done that off-Broadway twice. It was done, I'm going back now, if you can follow me. It was done off-Broadway very badly, as usually happens off-Broadway, despite all the myths about off-Broadway. The production was dreadful. It was amateurish and miscast. And the theater said to me, oh, well, we really support playwrights, and so we won't ask the critics. And then they asked every single critic in New York to come. And I stood at the door and said, "Go away!" I did. Really, I did. And the theater was very angry, and they barred me from the theater from that day on. And then there was that. And there was a year later, by accident, the play was done some other place off Broadway, the place called the Direct Theater. It was done very well, very successfully. And Jimmy Coco, who had heard about the play from Terrence McNally, whom I'd worked with at Yale, came back from Europe on a Friday night and was looking for a play. On a Saturday, the review was published. He just happened to buy the New York Times that day, read the review, and said, "Oh, this is this play that I've heard about," went and saw it, loved it, and put into motion what became a production off Broadway, but it took him almost a year to do it because no producer would back it. But as it happened, it finally, Adela Holzer, the famous and beautiful, who's just been convicted on 55 charges of grand larceny, was finally the person he went to produce this play. Lovely, delicate Spanish lady. And as it happened, coincidentally, we opened at the Circle Rep 4 days or 5 days after Ben O'Blimpy opened off Broadway. So I had two off Broadway openings in the same week, and through absolute coincidence, you could never have said in 1,000 years that either of those plays would ever be done prominently, and the fact that two of them were at about the same time was amazing luck. And that sort of is what my career is. And when I say I wonder if there is any kind of theater in America, living theater, it's based on that. I mean, I'm not complaining about my fate, because in the long run I have been, as I say, extraordinarily lucky, but I don't know that you can count on that kind of luck. And I don't know how many of you really write plays or know people who do, but if you do, you are counting on that kind of luck. There's no place for you to go in an orderly fashion that you can get your plays mounted in a professional, sensible way. And I think that despite the agitation at the New York Times and their insisting that there is a whole bunch of new playwrights, I think the fact is that there is really no theater for new playwrights. That in fact, little by little, what little there was 5 years ago is simply waning. All those opportunities are shrinking and not building. I think the reasons are complex. There's inflation, which we all know about. But it has meant that the costs of producing plays have risen enormously. You can't do a musical, for example, for less than $2 million. And Michael Bennett just lost $2,400,000 on Ballroom. You can't do a moderate cast small play for under $250,000 to $500,000 on Broadway. The chances of earning that kind of money back is tiny. What this does is it means the ticket prices have gone up in 10 years from something like a $7 or $8 top to a $20 and a $22.50 top and are increasing. And what that means is that ordinary middle class people, I hope you're all middle class, I don't want to be accused of being nasty, but all the ordinary middle class people do not go to the theater because they can't afford that kind of money. And when you're called upon to pay for two tickets something close to $50 plus a night out, you think twice. No matter how much you love the theater, you think twice. And when you do go to the theater, you go to the surefire thing. You go to the something that the critics love. You go to something that your friends love. You go to something where you're sure to have a wonderful time. For example, I happen to think they're playing our song is rather empty-headed and silly, but it's undeniably very enjoyable. And if you were to ask me, well, should I spend $150 or $200 to commute from Philadelphia to see this musical, should I? I would say, well, probably, because if you go see X play by Y playwright, you may not like it. It may have a lot of dirty words in it. It may be a situation that you're uncomfortable with. Well, sure, if you're going to spend $10, you might go and have an interesting time. But to spend $200, well, you should go see him playing our song, you see. And when that situation starts to happen, the single most important element of the theater is eroded, and that's the audience. And that's really what we've lost, I think. Now making a career in the theater has a lot to do with grants and critics and institutions of supposed higher education like Yale. But in fact, what all these people really overlook is you. Are the people who go and sit in the theater and laugh or applaud or cry and go home or get up and boo. And that's very, very important. The single most important element in the theater. The fact that something live is happening in front of you and that you can participate in that. And when this starts going, as it has, when people stop going to the theater because they can't afford it, because they're not interested, because they're offended or bored, or they don't know what to make of what's happening, when that starts happening, the theater dies. And I think that that's what has happened, in fact. I think it is happening everywhere. Fewer and fewer people will go to the theater. And that's, I think, terribly sad. When I write my plays, what I'm mainly interested in, though it doesn't always seem so, is communication. I don't mind it when an audience is offended. I mean, it doesn't excite me the way it does some people. You know, I mean, I know somebody who says, oh my God, they hated it. Ah! I'm not like that either. It bothers me. But, I mean, I can respect audiences that react with a certain amount of hostility or anger, because I think that's part of it. That's part of the excitement of going to the theater, is being challenged by what you see. What really bothers me as a playwright is feeling that there isn't an arena for me or for any of my colleagues who write plays. That you either must write for a specialized audience, which essentially is the off-Broadway audience in New York, or you simply write in a vacuum and hope against hope that those series of coincidences that happened once for me will happen again. And that's the difficulty. I suppose I should talk a little bit about critics, too. I think I saw Ernie Scheer come in. I will tell you a story about Ernie Scheer, is that I met him at the O'Neill, where I went for two summers. I don't know, do many of you know what the O'Neill is? The O'Neill is a place that does new plays, essentially, that has a supposedly developmental point of view about them, and they invite a lot of people up and so on. They do good work, and they're very supportive of playwrights, by and large. And Ernie Scheer is there a lot, is in residence there as a critic. And he was in Philadelphia, and we met and talked. And he wrote a little article about me, which I loathed. And I said, Ernie Scheer, how could you do that? But he was very nice about it anyway. When I was left Yale and had nothing to do, I substitute taught for 2 weeks in a very upper middle class prep school in New Jersey and nearly died. I got caught in the guerrilla warfare that was practiced by the students on everybody, including the teachers and the other students. This is the place where I think the tuition was enormously high, but all the teachers would congregate for lunch and cry. It's true, literally. So every day there was a different teacher crying for one reason or another. And these being very wealthy children, these children had learned sophisticated ways of hurting people. It's true, unfortunately. And so they would always pick out the weaknesses of teachers, like talk about their husbands or their children. And they'd always find out if they had died or they were sick. So it was very unpleasant. So I only lasted 2 weeks there. And I was crazier than the children. You see, and you can't be that, one thing. But I was sent back to Philadelphia. I had nothing to do, and I wanted to go to New York. And I ran into Ernie Scheer and said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I have to go to New York. I can't stay here because I really have to do my plays. He said, I will help you. And he lent me some money, and I got to New York. So actually, in a large way, I want to thank him for that, because it was really wonderful of him to do that. And those are the things I think one remembers, you know, when one has a career, is the gestures of people who have faith for no reason, because although I think Ernie had seen my plays and sort of liked them, there was no reason to think that he would be vindicated for that, you know, and that was very nice. But so I can't hate critics too much after that. My feeling about critics is very similar to what I was saying about the erosion of the audience, because the main problem with the power critics have, and I think they have an enormous amount of power, is that people like you delegate your authority to the critics. You let somebody else tell you what you're going to like or not like. And again, when that happens, one of the most important things in the theater goes, which is a spontaneous interest and a spontaneous excitement about what's happening. No one has a right to tell you what you're going to like. I mean, it's not a question of being right or wrong. I could tell you that I hated Gemini and make a perfectly good case about it. You know, oh, it doesn't add up, it has a lot of dirty words, blah, 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 and you might go and love it. You know, I remember all the wonderful people in the theater who said, oh, this play isn't funny. Gemini, I'm never going to laugh, it's heavy-handed, the audiences will never like it, it's not commercial. And then I go in the theater and see that it's sold out and the audience is roaring with laughter. I remember the many people who said to me, this play will never run a week on Broadway. It has run, I think, how many performances has it done? 795, did we look in Variety today? 795 on Broadway alone. So my only point is that if you really use somebody else to tell you what you're going to like, you're missing out. But again, because of the money involved, I understand why that happens. But that's what I mainly feel about critics. It isn't a matter of critics all being destructive or wrong or ugly or vicious, though many of them are, unfortunately. It's really more a matter of one man or woman telling thousands of other people what they're really going to like. And how does anybody know that? Well, no, I think the problem is deeper. I don't think it's the fact of critics alone, because there have always been critics and there's always been reviewers. But I point out this difference. When Ibsen was writing his plays, Ibsen made a career not a big commercial career, but he made a career. His plays got produced, people went to see them, he got royalties, he didn't starve to death. Most critics hated his plays, except for Shaw, but a great many other critics loathed them. You look at the reviews of A Doll's House or Ghosts, you find that people called it a sewer, canker, that they hated these plays. But people went to see them anyway. And the reason people went to see them is because one of the main functions of the theater is the communication. Theater is now. It's not something that's going to, you know, Gemini may not be relevant in 15 years, or may not have been relevant, it could not have been done 10 years ago. It's now. It's about things that people are interested in now on a certain level. And one of the reasons people go to the theater is to be confronted, not in an awful way necessarily, but to deal with issues that excite them and are of interest to them. And Ibsen was dealing with that. When he wrote Ghosts, he was not only dealing with venereal disease in a titillating way, he was dealing with hypocrisy in a bourgeois society. When he wrote A Doll's House, he was dealing with the problem of women in a middle class suddenly comfortable, wanting to strike out on their own, not being stuck bearing children. These were then especially not so familiar as they are now, and they're important issues. And an audience went to be confronted with those issues because it's exciting to see a point of view demonstrated to you theatrically, you know. And that's what I think is so important about the theater. When you have a critic who gets in the way of that, who's not simply expressing an opinion which you can read and forget and go and find out for yourself, but who stops you from going, something essential in the theater, the spontaneous need for that sort of interaction with an artist's vision is lost. And that's what I mean about, I wouldn't disestablish critics, I wish there was somebody who could get the theater going again, that they could have their say and then the rest of you could find out what you felt. The last time I commented about Robert Brustein, he threatened me with a suit. I dislike Robert Brustein very much for a variety of reasons. Personally, because I think he's a hypocrite, and professionally, because I think he's a hypocrite. I don't know if I really want to go into it too much. You see, I think Robert Brustein is the worst kind of shark that the water of the American theaters spawned, and that's called a bandwagon hopper. A shark, I think, is someone who feeds on other people. Isn't that true? And Robert Brustein is a great one for co-opting the work other people have done and pretending it's his, for writing illiterate articles in the New York Times, putting down talented people and exalting untalented people whom he has adopted. He's a great one for enshrining a kind of amateurism. Well, people are walking out already, isn't it wonderful? I'm sorry, go ahead if you have an appointment, I don't mean to embarrass you. Look, I stand in the back of the theater and watch my plays all the time and say, why is he leaving? Okay, but Robert Brustein is and so that's what I think about Robert Brustein. Also, one of the great controlling factors of the American theater, as I see it, is amateurism. Is the fact that amateur work is often praised much over professional work. An idea, a consistently held idea of professionalism has died in the American theater, or is dying, and I think that Robert Brustein is part of that. This is a man who's never worked in the professional theater, who has never made his living in the theater, who has a private income, who has lived in a hermetic paradise called Yale for many years, and who can preach to us all about what constitutes a professional theater or a desirable theater artistically. I don't think the man knows. When you make your living in the theater, that you begin to find out what's happening, and he never has. And I just challenge his accuracy, I challenge his right to those opinions. And so I really dislike all of that. Well, regional theater used to be a big joke because it was made up of people who had failed in New York, generally speaking, and couldn't make it. But that has changed. There's still some of those people out there, but it's true. I mean, as it has become less and less feasible for people to make a living in the theater, which is true, it's almost impossible for anybody, actors, directors, or playwrights, to make a living. In fact, almost nobody does. People who work in the theater usually try to fund their work by doing television or movies. It's one of the reasons that most people do as much television and movies as they do, is it frees an actor or a director to devote 2 or 3 months to doing a play, or longer if the play runs. But I mean, and costs are less outside of New York. Secondly, more, I don't know how much of you this you know, but more, but the government of the United States has more and more gotten involved in funding theaters, funding arts. And I think that government funding, on some level, on an official level, is very close. Meanwhile, the National Endowment and other grant-giving organizations have an enormous amount to do with the theater that's active in America. And one of their criteria, since most of them don't know anything, I mean, people who give these grants usually don't know anything about the theater, what they decide to do is to give it to organizations, give these grants to organizations that seem to be healthy. so that regional theaters have gotten an enormous amount of grant money with which they've been able to buy first-rate talent. It's no longer true that you're seeing second or third-rate productions in the regionals. Sometimes you are still, but more and more very talented, very skillful people work in the regionals. And secondly, in the last few years, it has become chic to do new plays. There was a time in America where there was enormous resistance to doing new plays. And, I mean, it took Benno 8 years to get on. It took Gemini 4 or 5 years to go. There was enormous resistance to the fact that they were new, that they were simply plays that had not been done in England first or were not 55 or 60 years old. I don't know how many of you remember the year of the bicentennial, but the plays that were mostly done were The Count of Monte Cristo, Sherlock Holmes by, what's his name? Can't remember. Gillette, yes. These are the plays that were done, mostly. Boy Meets Girl. I mean, these plays from the 30s and before, of no possible relevance to any of us. I mean, I'm not even putting them down. I mean, they just were not. There are plays written 10 years ago or 5 years ago or last month that are just as entertaining and just as exciting and just as funny and just as innocuous, really. But these dreadful plays were done and dredged up. And the regionals were a big source of revivalism. Arvin Brown from the Long Wharf's career has been built, for example, on getting some grant organization to pay for his trips to London so he can bring back the productions he liked there by English playwrights. But that has changed. It's become very chic now to do new plays. It's become a ticket to an article in the New York Times if you've done a lot of new plays. And so these people who are all primarily careerists, like Gordon Davidson, you know, is an intense careerist, wants to have a great career, they have found that the best way to get the New York Times interested is to do a lot of new plays, and they've begun doing new plays. And because they can absorb the loss that happens when new plays happen, they can afford to do it. More new plays get done collectively in the regionals than get done on Broadway. I mean, their point of view is still to move the play to Broadway. That's still the crown for anybody. Everybody wants to move to Broadway. But that begins now, instead of off-Broadway, or off-Broadway, which was the case a while ago, it begins in the regionals now. I don't know. I mean, I am speaking very generally. I would say that whenever you have an artificial process, you have a censorship of a sort. Now, we all think of censorship in sort of as cutting out or closing down, but not necessarily. You have a negative kind of censorship, which is that you fund certain kinds of work and don't fund others, that you allow certain people to control your funds with their tastes. That's the main problem. It isn't so much that someone in the government or someone in any of the, thank you very much, that someone in one of the grant-giving bodies says, oh, we cannot have plays about Italian-Americans from Philadelphia, or we can't have plays about this or that or the other. It's more that the money goes to people with certain tastes who are often conservative in their tastes or peculiar in their tastes. And that's it's a kind of a negative. It's a tricky situation. And the more undefined it is, the trickier it is, because a lot of times you don't know where this money is coming from or who it's coming from or what the real conditions were. I don't want to sound paranoid. I mean, it's a very complicated and difficult thing. But it's an important one, because that's, if we have live theater in the next 10 years, that's where it's going to come from increasingly, because there's no way that the theater can be supported, it seems to me, in the public. Well, I can answer that question in two ways. One of them has to do with writing with television, because I have written for television. I wrote something called Verna U.S. O'Girl. I don't know how many of you saw Verna U.S. O'Girl. It's quite an experience. Now I have just written the film for CBS, God Help Us All, which was a terrible, terrible mess, and which is a mess still ongoing because of the film company now. That's a crazy situation that happens in television. But I was thinking about this because of when you mentioned rewriting and so on. I've rewritten much more for television than I ever have for a play, because I think that television is, although everyone despises television, rightly, it's nonetheless a very, very difficult medium to catch the tone of, because you are writing on a very low level, or relatively. I mean, you're writing also on a corporately directed level, in the sense that what gets on that screen is always by committee. The sponsor and the head of the network and the producer and the director and probably the star and the writer they replace you with when they fire you. All those people will have some say into what gets on the screen. So that naturally you really have this incredibly touchy situation in television. Plays exist in a different world, in the sense that the controlling vision, ideally, should be the writers. that in a sense it's in the writer's head. When you write for television or movies, you're writing usually as an employee of somebody else. Somebody comes to you and says, I want to hire you to write this, or I would like you to develop that for me, or do you have an idea that I could buy? When you write on your own, you're starting with your own pulp, your own interior obsessions and ideas and points of view. So I don't think you revise as much, frankly. I think that you have a much more full-grown idea of what you're going to do. And I think different genres, like comedy is always the most revision-oriented, because comedy depends a lot on the audience, and an audience tells you what's funny and what isn't funny and what's interesting and what's not, and you change a lot, I think, when you comedy. Like in Gemini, although Gemini goes back and forth from being a comedy to being something else, and worse by some taste, we did change a lot. As we found, the audiences would not get things or would take longer to catch on and so on. We did change. So in comedy, you do rewrite more. But television, I think, in movies, is the most rewritten. And how long does it take to do a play? Well, it took Noel Coward a weekend to do Private Lives, right? Is that what he said? I think that it depends. You can work on and off on a play for a long time. I don't know if that really counts. You can work in production a lot. You can put a play in a workshop, like Joe Papp puts plays in a workshop. And so supposedly the playwright rewrites it, then it does another workshop, and it may go on to a... You know what I mean? It depends on what you mean. And it depends on the impulse. I'm suspicious of people who say they've worked 15 years on a play. I mean, a play takes place in space and time. It takes place now. And because of that, you don't labor... You know, there's something about that motor. To get it happen, to let it happen, to make it happen. And I think that when one writes a play, one tends to feel very wrung by it, that one wants to really get it out. So I don't think it takes... To get a rough draft shouldn't take too long, if you know what you're doing. You know, if it's... And then you may rewrite that depending on what you learn from that draft. But I don't think it's that much time. It's like practicing the piano. You know, when you can hear... when I was studying the piano, Andre Watts had his lesson next door to mine, right before me, and I would have to sit outside and listen to him play the piano. Well, let me tell you, if you ever heard an elephant without a hand play the piano, this is me. And I would say, now, why does Andre play as well as that when I practice probably as much as Andre does? And that's the thing. I mean, Noel Coward could write that in the weekend because he was very good at writing that kind of play. It might take me 40 years. But so I mean, I don't know that there's anything. With play, I'm a great believer in plot, though everyone who writes about my plays says otherwise. Oh, I have a story about Yale, which I shouldn't tell you relevant to that. There's a teacher at Yale called Richard Gilman. I don't know how many of you know him. He's a very intelligent man. He's a very good, very, very good critic. But he has his strange little tics. And at Yale, when they first read Ben O'Blimpy at Yale in the playwright's class, now at Yale, the actors would never be in the playwright's class. They would do their best. They would get sick. They would have hysterical pregnancies. I mean, they would do everything to get out of being in the playwright's class. So what happened usually was that the playwrights read the plays from Mr. Gilman, who would then say, oh, this is good, or this is bad, or you should do this, or whatever, right? So I brought in Ben O'Blimpy when it was in the first draft in my first year at Yale. And the part of the mother was read by a Nicaraguan student who had been in America maybe 7 weeks, that term. And Ben O'Blimpy himself was read by an Irish playwright who was thrown out of the school the next day and whose grasp on English was so peculiar as to belie his being Irish. And these two people read. Of course, they could not read. They were reading cold. They had never read the script before. They read it. Richard Gilman, after this, said to me, oh, it's so wonderful that you're not writing realistic plays. In the New York Times, 6 years later, Richard L. Gilman wrote a Sunday piece about how realism had returned and was strangling the American theater yet again. And to prove this was Alberto Nerado's play, The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpy. So, but I am a great believer in plots. I think plots are very important, especially in the theater, because you need something to hang what happens on. And a plot or a sequence of events structures for you the experience and structures for the audience. So I think that plotting is very important. And I always start with a plot. I think it's very important to know what's going to happen next for the writer in the play. And I think if you don't know that, you get into this incredible free associative terrain, which is the bane of all modern drama, because most plays that are written in that are just incredibly boring for good reason. You're not supposed to say they're boring. You're supposed to say, oh, they're profound because they don't make sense. Well, that's nonsense. Well, they don't add up. I'm very conservative when it comes to that. And so I think a plot is how I start, usually, a happening, what's going to happen. And then I start working with characters. Well, I think it's a comedy. I mean, I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, people laugh at weird things, but I can't say that it's. I don't know how many of you know the play. I mean, did you see it here? You saw it here, and I don't know how many of you know this play. I think that to begin with, it is a comedy. I think that the end, ideally, when it works, and I must admit, it doesn't work all that much. But when it does work, the beginning is funny, and increasingly, an audience hopefully is drawn in by the humor, and the last half hour or so becomes suddenly more serious. I mean, in two of the plays of mine that have been most prominently done, the Benno and Gemini. There's a tactic, which is that the people seem initially to be excessive and grotesque and funny, and that little by little, hopefully, one becomes aware that underneath all of that there's a certain humanity. And in Ben O'Blimpy, where you have a monstrously fat man or boy eating himself to death, and his family situation, which is an unhealthy one, to put it mildly, the tactic is to make it as funny as possible to begin with. You see people more or less as humorous. And then little by little, you begin to realize that there's a lot of pain. In The Mother, for example, I mean, The Mother is a very funny part, or should be, and is when the play is successfully done. And if she's not funny, you hate her. If she's funny, you begin to realize that the source of her bitchery or viciousness in the situation is a terrible pain, that's the only way she can go on living and deal with her pain, is this anguish that she has. And it comes out as a very nasty humor. Well, let me see. I have just done. I did a movie for CBS. God help us. And it's just still in the works, I guess. That's a job. I mean, I took that as a job and got sort of roped into spending more time than I really meant to. I'm working on a musical with Candor and Ebb. You know, they wrote Chicago and Cabaret and all those things. It's called The Rink, and it will probably open sometime in the fall. It's about a skating rink. It doesn't have too much skating in it, but it takes place in a skating rink. And I've worked with them for almost a year. I have a new play called Aggie, which oddly enough, Elliot Martin may produce. He's going to be here next, right? But oddly enough, maybe I shouldn't say this, you'll probably say, what? Never heard of that person. Who? Ina Raturo? You mean that greasy person who makes pizza? But, I don't know, but Elliot might do it. I don't know, it's around. And I hope that gets on next season. I really do. We're really hoping so. And there are some other possibilities right now, but that's essentially the things that are ready to go. Are you interested in that question? There are two distinctions to be made. One of them is writing plays, and the other one is making a career. And they are two different things. Making a career involves luck, as we've been saying. It involves being in the right place at the right time. It involves building up a certain number of contacts. It involves having enough control over your productions that you are not sabotaged by actors and directors who will go to great lengths to sabotage you if you let them. That's making a career. Those are the elements. About writing a good play, well, I don't know. I mean, what goes into being a great symphony composer or a great opera? I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think artists, talented artists, are people who take seriously the responsibility to express the times they live in. And I think that's the most important thing about arts, about art. And that's why I'm an anti-revivalist. I would like to see revivals stop for a while and all new plays done, because I think that's where we are now. And I think it's exciting, if you love the theater, to see what people think about it. I am writing a novel. I'm writing a second novel, actually. I love to write, you see, and unfortunately, I don't know how much longer I can write in the theater. I'm not very, I mean, I know I seem very jolly. That's because I'm an Italian, you see. But I am not all that reassured about the state of the theater. I am very sad about the level of people that I have dealt with in my life in the theater and continue to deal with. I'm not happy with them. I think that the level is very low in America. I think the level of professionalism is low. I think that a lot of the people who are controlling my destiny and the destiny of other playwrights, and to some degree actors and directors, are fools, lots of them. I mean, I can't pretend that I have a high opinion of a lot of the people who are powerful in the American theater. So that one looks naturally for ways to survive as a writer. I can do a lot of television and movies, but I'm not happy doing that either, because that's a very violating thing to do. I mean, you get paid very well for it, but it becomes a very it becomes a real circus, and it's a very dispiriting thing to do. So fiction remains a relatively pure form. I know that I have novelist friends who say, oh, you just haven't dealt with an editor, you don't know what that's like. But it seems to me that when you write a play, and you have a director up there who because of the American theater and the kind of mythos about directors will distort your work to make a point and to draw attention to himself, when you have actors who can't act, which is, I think, pervasively the case in the American theater, I hate to sound awful, but that's how I feel, I think that you're better off dealing with one person, you know what I mean, and seeing if you can get what you've done on paper. So that, yes, I am writing another novel, and I did write Wisdom Amok, which is also a play, by the way. It will be published. I did it as a novel first when I was at Yale, and it was almost bought by Viking, by Dick Seaver at Viking, and then it wasn't. It's not been published. We hope it will be eventually. Well, it's all done by negation. You see what I mean? When John Kander and Fred Ebb and I talk about who's going to direct our musical, I mean, we're all pretty successful people, and they're enormously successful. I mean, they've had a huge careers in the musical theater. We try to think of who we can go to, and you can probably count the number of good musical directors on a maimed hand. There just aren't many. In the theater, there are even fewer and fewer good directors. I don't know. I mean, I can think of two or three. I can think of some young directors whom I've worked with at Yale, or Peter Shifter, who did Benno off-Broadway and Gemini on-Broadway, who is doing this movie for CBS. Peter Shifter's a talented director. I mean, there are some younger directors who are talented. There are a few of the old standbys. But it seems to me that in the American theater, there's an enormous gap between the ages of 25 and 40. I don't know why. I think that was a period where the American theater sort of seemed to go into eclipse for a while. But you have Kazan and Josh Logan, and Jose Quintero, maybe, and then who do you have? I mean, they're older men, they're men over 50, way over in the case of Kazan, I think Josh Logan. And then who do you have? Where are our artists in their primes? Where are our 38 to 50-year-old directors who are available to do? There aren't many, there are a few, you know, I'm not saying there's nobody, but there are very, very few. Similarly with actors. I mean, you find me 20 actors who can project in a theater. And by projecting, I don't mean, I mean, having the gift to be heard without seeming to scream, to be seen without mugging. There aren't many. There's one actress I know of in the American theater who is a great actress. That's Meryl Streep. She's 29. She's being overpraised, which I think she's unhappy about. But she's an extraordinarily gifted actress. But I can think of maybe one or two other very talented. Where are they? Where are the actors in their primes? You have Colleen Dewhurst. She's a woman in her 50s. Jerry Page is a woman in her 50s. I mean, where are they? George Scott. Where are the people in their 40s and 30s? They just, you know, where are they? And there's an enormous gap. And it's very hard to find directors and actors who are good, who will work on new plays. A lot of, like, Al Pacino and Richard III. I mean, he's perfectly within his rights, I suppose, to do Richard III. But, I mean, a lot of those actors will not do new plays. A lot of actors who are good and who are interesting and exciting don't want to do it. It's too big a risk. They don't want to expose themselves. They want to strut around and do Hamlet or King Lear or Richard III. Similarly, we praise these directors like that fool Serban. You know, I mean, there's the movement in the American theater I call the Balkan cheese movement, where these amateurs are imported from the Balkans and praised in the New York Times. I mean, did any of you see The Cherry Orchard? Well, I'll tell you a story about The Cherry Orchard. This is this production did any of you see it? Anybody see it? It was this production, maybe you liked it. Some people loved it. And in fact, I said to Joe Papp the next day, I hated that, Joe. He got up and walked out of the room. No wonder he never does my play. But it was this production that was done like a high school production of The Glass Menagerie in Hackensack, where nobody has any talent, but the teacher has lots of quote-unquote artistic sensibilities. There was a lot of drapery and lights, and people came down center and screamed, and everything was made too clear. You know, it was real Chekhov, right? And I went with a director named Tony Page, who's a well-known English director, and started the Royal Court, for example. And he's a friend of mine. I went with him. We sat there, and Irene Wirth was in this play. A very wonderful actress, by the way, so I'm not telling a story against her. She was quite a wonderful actress. But Serban had encouraged her to go too far in playing the part. And there was a point at which she calls her son Grisha, who's died. And she did, we were sitting there. Tony Page fell asleep within 15 minutes, snoring very loudly. Very loudly, fell asleep, snoring. Suddenly, at the end of the first act, Irene comes downstage and says, Grisha! Grisha! Like that, at the top of her lungs. Tony Page just wakes up and says, oh, that's just Irene. He went back to sleep. Which I thought was the best review of that production of the Church that I've ever seen. But there's a trend. There's tremendous tendency to overpraise directors, to exaggerate the value of directors in the American theater. Well, directors become important when the plays become unimportant or become less important. I mean, I don't really care. It doesn't prove anything to me if you take The Tempest and do it in the nude, at blackface, and with elephant tails. I really don't care. And if you sit down there and put the chapter in verse as to how it actually makes more sense to do it that way, wonderful for you. You go to the madhouse and spend a lot of time doing that with all the Shakespeare plays. I mean, really. You see, when the new play becomes unimportant, you have this glorification of directors. Directors did not exist in the theater till the turn of the century, and did not exist importantly in the theater till after the Second World War. You know, it was unheard of for a playwright to have to say to the director, please, Mr. Kazan, would you do that scene? Or for the director to say, Mr. Williams, you cut that scene or I don't do your play. I mean, it's nonsense. There's no textual integrity. There's no love of the text. And I think that what unfortunately happens is that supposedly responsible commentators on the theater scene, like the critics in the New York Times, for example, who are not all stupid or hopeless, but I mean, there is a tendency to exalt what I think of at the best is debatable distortions of received work, rather than trying to find where I think the most important thing is, which is the playwright. The playwright and the actor. I think the theater is an actor's art and the playwright's art. It's not a director's art. Movies are a director's art. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it depends on the atmosphere the director creates. Some directors are very hospitable to new writers, and some are not to the writer. Some directors are threatened to have the writer there, and will not work with the writer or cooperate with the writer under any set of circumstances. They say, stay out. And unfortunately, I have learned to avoid that kind of director, though I had a very bad experience with Ulysses and Traction with precisely that sort of atmosphere, and it was very unfortunate. But, usually you try. It's a working situation. It's a collaborative situation. You know, I think writers should go to rehearsals, should talk to the actors, should be there, should be available. And one does have some say in the casting, but again, the theater, William Goldman's book called The Season. Do you know that book? I would recommend reading that book if you're interested in about how the theater works. It was written 10 years ago, and it's a little dated in some aspects, and it's rather poisonous in tone. But it's very, very accurate about how the theater works. And there's something called the muscle. It's his term. And the muscle is the person who's calling the shots in the commercial production. It can be Kate Hepburn, if she's in your play, or the star. It can be the director, if it's Kazan. It can be the playwright, if it's Edward Albee or Tennessee Williams. It's whoever's name above the title is going to sell some tickets. When Albert Inarritu first came along, not only did no one know his name, but no one could pronounce it. So naturally, Albert Inarritu was not consulted a lot. And you learn. You know, it's a very cruel thing. So in actuality, a lot of it has to be how pushy you are, how tough you are, how aggressive, and so on. Anybody else? Nobody else. Okay. Thank you very much for being so attentive. Thank you.